Our knowledge of Slavic pre-Christian religion is quite limited. This episode gives an overview of what we think we do know and how. Welcome to the podcast Tru og Meining I Gammal Tid. I'm Eldar Heide, and our guest today is Jiri Dinda. Welcome, Jiri.
Hello, Eldar, and thanks for having me on the podcast.
You're welcome. So, could you say a bit about yourself and your background?
Yes. Well, my name is Jiri Dinda, and I work at the Institute of Slavonic Studies at the Czech Academy of Sciences in Prague, Czech Republic. Now, by training, I'm a religious studies scholar, and my passion lies in exploring what some might call the ancient religious traditions or dead religions, maybe. Specifically, I've got my eye on the old Slavic pre-Christian or pagan religions.
So dead religions, you're a historian of religion.
Yes, I'm intrigued by the way these ancient religions were, how they faded away or died, and whether religions can actually die at all. That's the big question for me. So I spend my time digging into topics like Christianization or syncretism. That's the blending and mixing of different religious tradition.
Certain elements survive and then they're mixed. Mm-hmm. Right. So can religions die at all, or do they just change? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
But my main focus right now, however, is on how Christian authors, mainly from the Middle Ages onward, talked about Slavic paganism. How did they describe it? How did they shape our understanding of it? To what extent this picture was biased, and what can we do about it? So it's basically source criticism, and it's all about getting a better grasp of Slavic religion.
Yeah. So Christian authors writing some centuries after the conversion of the Slavs, they knew, they had some pieces of information about the old religion, and then you discuss how we can use that material, how we can understand it, what was their purpose of what they did, things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. What was the ideological background of their works and their biases and so on?
Yeah. Right. Biased people, yeah. So people were biased back then too. It's not a modern thing. Okay. Yeah. Slavic pre-Christian religion, or Slavic paganism, as I see it's often called. It's interesting but difficult. There's not much we know. So we'll talk about that today. We know something, that's for sure. But perhaps first a bit about the Slavs. Who are the Slavs, and who were the Slavs? Where did they come from?
Yeah, maybe we can start by unpacking the term the Slavs, because much like the, for example, the Celts or the Germanic people, it's a label that's both useful and somewhat problematic. When we refer to the Slavs during the Middle Ages, it's essentially a sort of external label for a range of probably different ethnic groups. However, these groups did share some commonalities. First, it was undeniably a common language
Yeah, so it, and it's based
known.
upon language. It's you say it's
Yes, one
labels.
of the
So
criteria.
yeah, the cultures can have been may have been quite different, but yeah, a common language. So different tribes speaking this common language.
This language was in the earliest Orchid Slavonic sources described as Jenzik Slovenisk, which means basically Slavic language. And the interesting thing is that in the 9th century, this language was understood by both Western Slavs in Great Moravia, for example, and Southern Slavs
Moravia,
settled.
where is that?
That's the territory of today Czech Republic,
Yeah, okay.
basically.
And then the
But
Southern Slavs, that is
and Southern
in.
Slavs settled it, what we now know as Greece,
Right, and
used a
Yugos.
dialect that was understandable in Great Moravia, specifically when those two brother saints, Cyril and Methodius, came to Great Moravia and brought this language of literature, which is called Orchard Slavonic.
Yeah, Old Church Slavonic, and that's the earliest written form of the Slavic languages. And yeah, maybe we should say a bit more about that, because that's quite important, I guess, for what we later know about the Slavs.
Yeah, certainly. Constantine was his name before he changed his name to Saint Cyril, just a few months before he died. This Constantine, called the philosopher, was tasked with the quest to invent a script for Slavic languages in order to bring liturgy, Byzantine liturgy, to Great Moravia on request of the prince of the Great Moravia. So what he did was that he invented a script called Glagolitic, and with his brother Methodius, they started to translate the Gospels and later other biblical books from the Old Testament, and brought those books and liturgy into Great Moravia, where they met with disrespect on behalf of Latin priests from the Frankish Empire.
Yeah. So, but their
So
background was the Greek language and Greek written tradition. So in northern Greece, that's where they came from, right?
yeah, they came from Thessaloniki region in Greece, and it is hypothesized that their mother probably was of Slavic origin, so Slavic language was their mother tongue. So
Right, and
they were bilingual probably.
one of these brothers was called Cyril, so hence the Cyrillic language, Kyrillic alphabet,
Yeah.
the Cyrillic alphabet, sorry.
Yes. The irony of this name of script is that it was invented only after his death, because he was the inventor of Glagolitic, which is much more complicated than Cyrillic. Cyrillic is basically based on Greek alphabet, so
Yeah. Okay.
Cyrillic is the simplified form
Yeah.
or the transcription of Slavic languages.
So irony in history too. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So and then in the Viking Age, which would be the latest part of Slavic paganism, then there were Slavic speaking peoples all the way from northern Greece. What used to be Yugoslavia and up to Poland and Eastern Germany and east from there to Ukraine and Western Russia, right?
Yes. That's what I was trying to say, and that we have certain criteria for labeling ethnicity as a Slavic. First is the language. Second was a kind of distinctive common material culture, characterized probably by some specific clay pots and particular architectural style featuring pit houses and so on.
Pit houses,
And
okay.
Speedhouses, yes. And third criteria was probably criterion was probably that these various groups of people shared elements of their religious systems, likely. Although this common religion eventually evolved into regional variants. Now, what happened is that
So just,
Slavs appeared first. I'm sorry.
well, they, where did they come from, the Slavs? They spread out as a result of the migration period, 5th, 6th centuries, spread out into this huge area. Where was their homeland?
Actually, the first appearance of Slavs, of people known as Slavs in written sources, occurred in the 5th and 6th centuries on the fringes of Byzantine Empire. But then, later, in the 9th century, large portions of Eastern, Southern, and Central Europe, as you said, already saw people speaking various dialects of common Slavic language. And what precisely happened during this period remains a bit unclear. Was it demographic expansion and colonization, maybe? Did it involve cultural spread of the material culture, or perhaps the concept of Slavic ethnicity, Slavic ethnic identity held some unique appeal, so it spread like a cultural innovation throughout the Europe, leading to the cultural and linguistic adoption across Europe.
Yeah, but
The
from
truth
some.
is that we don't have all the answers. The theory of demographic expansion tries to localize the homeland, which could be probably somewhere near Pripyat Marshes, which is on the borders of today's Belarus and Ukraine.
Pripyat.
Pripyat,
Yeah.
yes. But the sheer demographic expansion cannot account for what happened and how the Slavic ethnic identity really dispersed over the Europe. So maybe there were some other processes at play.
Good commercials
And
on TV, maybe, or TikTok.
maybe.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So, be a Slav. That's good for you. Something
Yeah.
like that. Yeah.
But now, the topic is controversial, of course, because discussions about origins of the Slavs often touch upon the origins of modern nations and their ethnic identities, so it can become politically charged.
Yeah.
But I think in conclusion, when we study the ancient Slavic culture and religion, we just need to realize that we are examining the lives and religions of people with diverse ethnic and cultural backgrounds.
Yeah.
It's clear they spoke some common language and may have shared similar religious beliefs, but their origins and identities were far from uniform.
Yeah. I guess they, if they expanded, they would conquer other peoples, other tribes, who would then pick up their language. So, because in order to spread a language over a certain, well, you don't have millions and millions of people to spread, so it's much easier to make the conquered people speak your language. That's, yeah, like
Yes, exactly.
known from many, many processes in later times. Yeah, and then the conversion. When were the Slavs converted?
Well, given the wide regional dispersion of Slavic tribes across Europe, the Christianization happened at various times and from different directions, from Orthodox Church as well as from the Catholic Church, from East and West. Generally speaking, the South Slavs, folks like the Croats, the Serbians, the Bulgarians, and others, they embraced Christianity in the 9th century. Moving over to the East Slavs, they followed in the 10th century. And as for the West Slavs, their conversion spanned a broader period, taking place sometime between 9th and 12th centuries. The very last Slavic group to officially adopt Christianity were the so-called Polabian Slavs, the westernmost Slavs settled in what is today Eastern Germany. and specifically the last ones were the Rugiani tribe, or Rani, who were settled on the island of Rügen in Germany, and their conversion happened in 1168.
Yeah, that's
and it wasn't
quite
exactly
late.
Voluntary.
Right. Yeah, they were given an offer they couldn't refuse.
Yes.
Yeah, and East Slavs, that's in Ukraine and Russia, right? South Slavs will be Bulgaria, former Yugoslavia, those areas. Mm-hmm. And then the West Slavic areas will be present-day Poland. Yeah, and then Eastern Germany, as it used to be, and the Czech Republic,
and Czech
Slovakia.
Republic and Slovakia, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and then for the conversion, there was one wave from the southeast, from Byzantium, so Greek Orthodox faith, and then the Catholic faith from the west of Europe,
from the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah, and from the south, of course, as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I promised that the listeners would get to know what we think we know about Slavic pre-Christian religions. So maybe we should start with the gods, the major gods. You mentioned before we started the recording that there's this division between East and West.
Yes. Maybe I should mention that when it comes to Slavic religion, we don't have anything quite like the Edda, whether it is the poetic Edda or the prose Edda.
Yeah, from Old Norse religion.
What do we have? Yeah. What do we have are numerous written sources about Slavic religion from distinctly Christian perspective or from some Arabic travelers and diplomats. And I already mentioned that it's crucial to approach these sources with caution, recognizing their ideological and theological biases. But despite that, these sources can still provide us with valuable insights into Slavic beliefs and rituals. So we have to put together the evidence we have and put together big picture. And the big picture is that there were certainly regional differences between various Slavic domains. We can start with the Eastern Slavs. We have what's known as the Kievan Rus, and there what is called Vladimir's Pantheon. In the year 980, Prince Vladimir took the reins of power after his brother and initiated the transformation of pagan pantheon, pagan worship. And as part of this reformation, he reconstructed the sacred cult site right in the center of Kiev. Thanks to some sources, we got names of several deities from this sanctuary. So that's where we can start.
Yeah. Kievan Rus, maybe we should say a bit more about that. I mentioned in an episode from July about low-tech navigation, that the name Russia comes from, it's the same word as Ruotsi, meaning Sweden and Swedish as well, in Finnish, and ultimately derives from the east coast of Sweden, that part called Roslagen, and Ros must have been Rodz, pronounced like that in the early Viking age. So it's this legend about, well, ultimately depends upon the Scandinavian influence in Western Russia and Ukraine in the Viking Age. So so Rus, like as in Russia, refer to the Scandinavian Slavic mixed population and mixed culture, I guess we should say. So the Kievan Rus, and so Kiev was the center of this culture in the late Viking Age, and that's where you get your first sources, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And you're right that the Scandinavian influence in Kievan Rus was very important, because the ruling dynasty, the Rurikid dynasty, has its origins in Scandinavia. Those sometimes they are called Varangians or Variags. They were of Norse origins, even though they were Slavicized quite
Yeah.
early.
So
So,
Varangians, it's the English form of Varingar, is the
yes,
common term
exactly.
in Norwegian and well, Scandinavian. It refers to, among other things, the Scandinavian guard at the Emperor's court in Constantinople. So Varingar, the word, the etymology of the word is somewhat obscure, but in any way, that's a term for the Scandinavians in the East.
Yeah, and because of this influence, for example, first god we have to mention is Slavic Perun, who was Slavic thunder god, and since he was the central figure in the pantheon
You're talking
and
about
held significant position, East Slavic,
East
yes,
Slavic, yeah.
and he held significant position among the Varangian elite. And because of their origins, we may speculate about the influence of some of a Thor-like deity on the image of Slavic thunder god. Even though we know that the Varangians were Slavicized and they accommodated to the customs and language and so on. So we, for example, know that Perun had a multifaceted role. He not only controlled the weather, linking him to fertility, but he also had a martial side, making him a war god, basically. So
Yeah.
that's somehow similar to Old Norse Thor. The etymology of Perun's name is quite fascinating, because it might have Slavic roots stemming from the verb perti, meaning to strike or to beat, which is understandable
Okay.
when we are speaking about a war deity.
Oh yeah.
Yet it may reach even back further because it may have deeper Indo-European roots, maybe cognate with Proto-Indo-European root percu, which is linked to terms like Latin quercus, sort of oak, type of oak, and
Oak tree.
that's oak tree,
Yeah.
yes,
So
or Hercynia silva, Hercynian forest in Europe.
the thunder will strike oaks more often than other trees, because of their very deep roots, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe there was a connection even to Hittite word birunash, meaning a rock. So it was a semantic field between a mountain rock and a tree, oak tree. Through this Proto-Indo-European heritage, Perun might be cognate with deities like, for example, Lithuanian Perkūnas, Latvian Perkons,
Yeah,
and maybe Old Norse
that's
Fjörgyn.
the Baltic thunder god Perkūnas,
Yes.
and Latvian, say it again, please.
Perkons.
Perkons, yeah. Yeah, so Perun, Perkūnas, Perkons, yeah. It sounds very similar, and yeah, we should add, I guess, the Finnish swear word perkele, that many know both in Scandinavia. Perkele is believed to derive be a loan word from these Baltic languages. So
yeah.
Really, it means the thunder god.
Yeah. So to wrap up, we can speculate that what happened is that his original Indo-European name, reconstructed as Perkūnas or something like that, which could translate as a lord of the oak or lord of the mountain, was later in the Slavic tradition through folk etymology linked to the Slavic verb to strike. So the Indo-European heritage was through folk etymology interpreted in Slavic way.
Yeah. Okay, and he was really important, right, among the Eastern Slavs, Perun?
Yeah, he was very important, and he granted victories in battle, and he was also guarant of contracts, like business contracts with the Byzantium was overseen by Perun.
Okay. So something really solid as a guarantee. Yeah. Okay. More East Slavic gods.
Yeah, we can move to onto Dashbok, or sometimes he's called Horse Dashbok,
So
because there is a
Dashbog,
possibility that horse is just
I guess we need
appellative
to spell
of
it.
this.
So
Yeah,
Dashbog,
Dashbok, D
and then
A
that's
Z D
Z with
O G.
a hat on it.
Yeah,
Yeah, BOG.
B O G. Bok means god in Slavic, in most Slavic languages. And Dashbok was probably the sun god,
Sun,
god
okay.
of sun. And in Slavic,
So,
Dashbok means the giving god,
okay.
etymologically. So his etymology is
So linked
quite straightforward.
to fertility then, the sun and sunshine.
Yeah, probably, probably. From other sources, we know that he was a son of Svarog, deity Svarog, who happens to be a blacksmith deity comparable to Hephaestus from a Greek mythology.
Okay.
Then in the Vladimir's pantheon, there is a Strybok, and while we are not entirely sure about his functions, he's often associated with wars and battles, as well as Perun. And then there is Simargl, who likely has Indo-Iranian origins and might be connected to the griffin, Persian griffin monster known as Simurgh.
Okay. Yeah. So the name Simargl. Okay,
Yes.
Simargl.
And the pantheon probably wouldn't be complete without a goddess. And that's Mokosh, the only known goddess in this pantheon. Mokosh later became associated with the fairies of South Slavic and East Slavic folklore, and she was linked to various aspects of women's work, household magic, and household practices. And her name probably means wet or moist, or is derived from the root meaning wet or moist.
Okay. You mentioned
And lastly, sorry.
childbirth in connection with her.
Yeah, through her association with the Vili, with the fairies, and Rožanice, she was associated with childbirth as a intrinsically women's labor.
Yeah, okay.
So
Spinning, things like that.
it's understandable. And spinning, of course.
Okay.
And lastly, in the East Slavic area, we have a very fascinating god called Veles, or Volos, which is the different spelling,
Volos,
simple
Veles, yeah.
VOLOLOS. He is often described with the epithet Scotty Bog, meaning the cattle god,
Cattle.
but maybe more broadly cattle god, maybe more broadly the beast god, because Veles likely had connections to pastures, herd protection, and cattle, of course.
Yeah. So
But
the beast god,
interestingly, he
what
also
was he himself seen as a beast, or more the promoter of cattle?
quite probably he was the protector of cattle, because he somehow ruled the animals in the forest,
Yeah,
who
okay.
could endanger the cattle. So he was in this position because of his ambivalent nature. He also had ties to the netherworld and to the realm of the dead, so that is
Okay.
probably connected to this complex, symbolic complex.
Yeah. So that was the pantheon, group of gods in the East Slavic area. So, what about the West?
If we look into the West, we see quite different situation. Among the Polabian Slavs, we come across various small tribes who were often joining together into what we call tribal federations. And within this complex relationships, web of relationships, one deity usually stood out and was elevated as the most significant among the many. That's what's interesting in those tribal confederations, that each of these primary deities took on multiple roles, spanning from fertility to divination, prosperity, and even war and battles. So they were multifunctional deities.
Okay, so more in the direction of monotheism, like Christianity, so more something
partly,
in between.
Something in between. This process is usually called henotheism, like from the Greek henos, which means one of the many, and not monos, one and only. So henotheism is a process where one god from the polytheistic spectrum is elevated into this central position.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
For instance, in Valetian Lutetian tribal confederation, the central figure was called Svarožic.
Svarožic. Okay, we need a spelling there, I think, too.
Yeah, S-V-A-R-O-Z-E.
Z with a hat on it. I see.
Z with a hat. I see.
Yeah.
Who bears some resemblance to the South Slavic mentions of a blacksmith god named Svarok, as I already mentioned him. He was a primary deity of this tribal confederation, where he played a role as an oracular deity, bestowing guidance for wars and battles.
Okay.
Similarly, among the Pomeranians, which is the tribe settled on near the coast of Baltic Sea in what is today Poland,
northwestern present-day Poland.
Northwestern. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Thank you. Their main deity was called the Triglav.
Triglav.
The very name Triglav translates to the three-headed one, the one with the three heads. And it is said that his statue had, not surprisingly, three heads, symbolizing his dominion over the three realms, heaven, earth, and the underworld.
Okay.
And Triglav also had the role of divination deity and had associations with sacred horses.
Yeah.
Which is a pattern that is applicable also for the primary deity of the Rani people on the island of Rügen.
Rügen, yeah.
The central figure of the Rügen cult of Svantovit was held at the sanctuary of Arkona.
That's another. So Svantovit, there was Svarožic, Triglav, and Svantovit, mm-hmm. Okay.
Exactly. And Svantovit was a four-headed deity, with his functions also extending into matters of war and the fertility, abundance of crops, and so on, and divination, of course.
So, gods with many functions, and each one of these were the main god in one region, or...
Mm-hmm.
Did this change over time as well?
In specific region and in specific time, because the prominence of those gods was changing how the political and historical situation changed over 200 years. So this was just the big picture from our perspectives.
Yeah, okay. So... how about goddesses in the West Slavic area?
Unfortunately, we have only one mention of a goddess in this area. Or exactly, there were two mentions, but one of them is found in the chronicle by Thietmar of Merseburg, who mentions that the Redarian tribe used to carry into battles war banners with the representation, visual representation of their goddess. And when they lost this war banner, they just went back home because they took it as a bad omen for their battles to come. And other chronicler in the 12th century mentions a goddess called Siva, who was supposed to be a goddess of Polabian tribe,
That was in present
which was
day
part
Eastern
of,
Germany.
yes. So these are only two mentions about goddesses in the West Slavic area.
What about cult sacrifices, cultic buildings, things like that?
We hear a lot about temple buildings that were used as assembly and gathering places for the tribe or the tribe council, as well as deposit for spoils of war and deposits for the statues of gods. We know that some sacrifices were held outside of those sanctuaries. We know that divination rituals were performed in front of those temples using sacred horses that were crossing the spears and divining whether the tribe should go on a war expedition or not. So this is what we know from the written sources, and we can supplement it with the evidence from the archaeological findings where some temples were excavated and found, or some structures and buildings that the archaeologists suppose were temples. And also archaeologically, some statues of gods were discovered.
All right. So temples, cultic buildings, yeah. And what kind of sacrifices did you say that?
Written sources mention usually the food offerings. When written sources mention human sacrifices, we should be sort of skeptical or wary because those reports, those accounts can be ideological propaganda, just trying to depict the paganism in the worst light possible. So, since we don't have any archaeological evidence of human sacrifices, we must read those accounts with caution. But there are some reports on human sacrifices. And animal sacrifices for sure were a thing among Slavs. Horses, cattle, boars, and so on.
Yeah, now we are already into the question of the sources, the source situation. Could you say a bit about that?
As I said, we have a lot of those Christian reports on Slavic paganism, which is filled with biased information and misunderstandings. But we have also later sources referring to paganism as to something as a remnant of bygone era of the ancestors. Of the chronicler, basically. In those national chronicles, the stories about paganism are just these prologues to the chronicle itself.
So
And
chronicles,
then we have,
historical works, and the
yes.
person writing it lives in an area where, when he traces his ancestors back, he comes to pagan times and says something about those times and what it was
Exactly.
like.
Exactly. Yeah, and the paganism is somehow constructed as a literary boogeyman or something that we should be, or the readers should be very off, and they shouldn't be instigating much. But then we have a specific type of sources that pertain to late Middle Ages. These are, for example, Christian sermons and law books prohibiting certain practices, and they depict paganism as a sort of internal threat in the society, in the Christian community, and they relate to paganism as something illegitimate that people are still doing, and
Okay,
the question is whether this is
so
an actual
how long after the conversion is this?
several dozens of years to hundreds of years. It's
Yeah.
really long period.
So it's like in the in Norway we have these the laws for the different regions from the third. Well, we know the version is from the second half of the 13th century, and there's a prohibitions of pagan practices, and then apparently this was still going on because otherwise you didn't have to prohibit it. So similar in Slavic areas, yeah.
But the important question for me is, when reading those sources, these sources, they often reflect or criticize the medieval popular culture, and Christian preachers and lawmakers sometimes found problematic certain practices. But does the problem is whether labeling something as pagan by Christian standards make it truly pagan, if you know what I mean, whether those reports on pagan peasants is really the defining criterion for paganism in those late periods.
Yeah, you mean it can doesn't yeah doesn't necessarily mean what would have existed something that w existed in pre-Christian times. Yeah, it may
Yeah,
have
that's correct.
turned into simply a negative word.
Yeah, but this so to say source shortage we have is actually a good thing, because we have to work even with those sources, and with limited direct sources to work with. Scholars of Slavic religion have to get pretty creative and in combining, for example, literary, archaeological, and folkloric evidence. So it's like piecing together a complex puzzle, combining, comparing, and taking together, collating various pieces of some historical jigsaw.
Right. Yeah, but the written information, you do have something from the time Slavic paganism still was a living religion, and then you have the later sources, chroniclers looking back, mentioning information they had that had survived, and then we have the archaeological material and finally the folklore, but then maybe you could say a bit more about the archaeology before we move on to the folkloric sources. You mentioned cultic buildings. Could you
Yes.
elaborate on that?
Well, while I'm not an archaeologist myself, I can only summarize some findings I know of, or the most famous ones. For example, regarding the temples, very important findings were excavated at a locality called Grossraden in Germany, where there was found assembly room interpreted as a temple, with some animal sacrifices behind the floor, below the floor of the building, and so on. And for example, also in Poland, in Wolin and Szczecin, temples that were probably associated with the cult of Triglav were excavated. But as far as I know, the interpretation of those cultic buildings is a quite challenging endeavor. So whether it is really a temple, whether it is just a building used for something else, for something we could say not very sacred, not sacred but profane activities, even though the sacred and profane as a category doesn't make really much sense in the world of ancient religions.
Yeah, because you would always
So
be within the religious sphere. There
yes,
was,
exactly.
the idea of something profane is probably modern. Okay, so the interpretation of these buildings, they could be assembly buildings, you said before we started recording. So.
Some researchers compare those buildings with Germanic Hof building, like this assembly building for the elite to gather and feast and just commute. But also regarding the archaeological sources, we could mention finds of the statues of gods. And in the territory of the Eastern Germany, there were found many wooden idols spanning from 7th to 10th centuries. And also on the territory of East Slavs, there were found, for example, very famous idol called Zbruch idol, discovered in a river near the Kamianets Podolski in Ukraine.
Okay, so but the wooden idols were also found in rivers or marshes. So that's how they were preserved.
Yes,
The lack
exactly.
of o oxygen in deep in the mud. Okay. So, but this Zbruch idol is that's of stone.
It's one of a few stone idols among Slavs, and it's very interesting because it has four heads. So that's the reason why it is sometimes called Svantovit of Zbruch, because it's quite the structure is similar to what Saxo Grammaticus tells about how the idol of Svantovit on Rügen looked like.
So Rügen, so present-day northern Germany. So Saxo Grammaticus, this Danish historian of the 13th century, he wrote about that, a really important text, I understand, because the Danes were conquering the area at that time in the 12th century, so a bit before Saxo. So, okay, so he describes Svantovit with the four heads. And the temple.
And the temple on Arkona, which was unfortunately not discovered and couldn't be discovered because the chalk cliffs of the island are receding to the sea. The sea is swallowing the whole island basically slowly, but so the fortress or the stronghold of Arkona
Which
is
was
mostly under the sea.
so placed on the highest point of the island to be easy to defend.
Yeah, it was the promontory of the.
So, but then, and this idol found in Ukraine also had four heads.
The Zbruch idol was found in 19th century in a river, again, near Slavic settlement from the early Middle Ages. So it sort of makes sense that the idol would be probably in the era of Christianization, tossed down from the settlement, from the stronghold into the river beneath it. So that's just a speculation because there are controversies recently that the idol might be falsificate from the Romantic era, but
So, like the
we
Kensington
don't know for
runestone.
sure.
So, this possibly fake stone idol. Okay. So, many layers of difficult interpretations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then what you say about the possible cultic buildings, whether or not they were temples or just assembly buildings, that reminds me of the Scandinavian debate. This famous book by Olaf Olsen, Hørg Hovkirke, from the 1960s, he argued that there were no specialized cultic buildings. It was the hall buildings, large buildings for the public feasts that were also used for all cultic purposes. But which has now been disproven after archaeologists started finding clear cultic buildings more than this smaller temple type. So that question isn't solved yet in the Slavic areas, then it seems. You have both lanes of interpretation.
Yes, and there are also theories about how these temples were influenced by the Christian churches.
Okay, then maybe we should turn to folklore. Yeah, so some legends or myths survived into Christian times or even post-medieval or modern times. But then I guess they assumed a new function that allowed them to survive because a story, in order to be retold, in order to survive, it needs to have a some kind of function or relevance in the culture.
Yeah, those sources, folkloric sources, were recorded mostly in the 19th and 20th century. And you're right that they may be our link for much older stories, carrying some hints of a distinctly non-Christian flavor, maybe. This non-Christian stories probably took the form of different genres of, for example, apocryphic literature, apocrypha or non-canonic literature,
So
Christian.
that's Christian literature that's that doesn't belong that didn't make it into the Bible.
Yes,
So
yes. And those stories tell some tales about origins of the world, or tales about origins of a man, which are not Christian for sure, and we can be 100% sure that they have origins in Slavic paganism, but they are our only hints and our window to this pagan times. So
So
maybe
pre-Christian stories that melted into the culture of Christian times.
yes.
Yeah. So could you mention an example of that?
Yeah, for example, it is this tales about origins of Earth are basically variants of the so-called Earth Diver myth. They found their way into those Christians' apocrypha, and they tell about two gods, basically, the one good one and the evil one, called God and Satan in those apocrypha. And the evil god or Satan has to dive to the bottom of the ocean to pick up a grain of sand from which the earth is created by the god. So this was recorded in our apocrypha, and later in a folklore that feeds on those apocrypha tales and folklore songs and so on, among South Slavs and Eastern Slavs.
Yeah, okay. So the earth diver myth, so this water bird dives to the bottom of the sea and swims up with a bit of mud from the bottom. And there's this the process of raising the earth up from the sea. And that is how the earth is created. Yeah. So, and this is a myth that we know from large or huge areas in northern Eurasia. So obviously this is something inherited in this part of the world, not something that came with Christianity. So it must be pre-Christian. Yeah. And apocrypha, maybe we should, I said something that didn't make it into the Bible, but more correct is maybe to say that it's Christian literature that is unofficial. It's understood as part of Christian learning, but unofficial. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So yeah, that's a good example, the Earth Diver myth. And we also talked about the stories about Elijah, the biblical figure, Old Testament figure. That's another example, isn't it?
Yes, it's an example of when some mythical material didn't just transform to different genre. It was so to speak transposed into stories about Christian saints. And for example, Orthodox saints such as Saint Nicholas or Saint Elijah are said to be influenced by some pagan deities. Probably Elijah, you mentioned, was probably blended with the Slavic thunder god, because Elijah as a saint in those folklore stories is grumpy and vengeful, and he rides in his chariot in above the sky and controls the weather and lightning and so on. So this shift allowed the pagan deities or their characters and motifs to enter a new context, new religious context and milieu, which is precisely what syncretism is all about, the blending of old and new, resulting into some new forms.
Yeah, so they
draw inspiration from both worlds.
So the Old Testament Elijah, or Elias in Norwegian, was connected to fire, brings fire down from the sky, according to the Bible. He enters heaven alive by fire and drives this fiery chariot from earth to sky. And he was then blended with the thunder god, who, at least we know from the Nordic countries, who drove this chariot and made fire. And had the same temper as you describe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those characteristics of Elijah you mentioned were probably the reason that made this Elijah figure, so to say, a good niche for accommodating features of pagan deity, the thunder god from pagan times. So, just a good spot for syncretism to happen.
Yeah.
Anyway, other mythical material that somehow took on a different life in the form of the East Slavic folklore is the epic tradition, epic songs known as Byliny.
Byliny.
Byliny, yes. The oral tradition that can actually trace its roots back to medieval Kievan Rus. But ironically, it was documented in regions far from its place of origin, in places like Russian Karelia and Arkhangelskaya Oblast, in the Russian north, near to Finland.
Yeah.
And here or there, among the simple peasants, those epic songs about heroes from the ancient times were sung. These songs were really epic, 30 minutes long stories about hero fighting dragon or fighting Mongol armies and so on, defending the motherland and so on. Very melodic songs, maybe somehow similar to Kalevala, maybe.
Yeah, so superhero songs.
Superhero songs, exactly.
The Finnish Kalevala, or the the Old Norse Fornaldarsogur, the legendary sagas, Fornaldarsaga, and also about superheroes meeting monsters of all kinds. So, okay, so that kind of stories, you believe, survived from pre-Christian Slavic times and in this,
yes, some
this
of them.
Genre?
Mm-hmm. Some of them, because generally speaking, Bilini are quite unique blend of historical and mythological elements. And scholars often assume that the weirdest and the most magical story elements in those songs have mythological origins. It's not always that straightforward, but it serves as a basic criterion for further analysis of possible mythological elements in those songs.
Yeah. Okay. And then also you find sometimes the name of a pre-Christian deity in fairy tales or legends from post-medieval times.
That's very, very rare. In some Christmas carols, there are supposed to be some names of gods, but it's not very, very common.
Okay.
It's not as common as in Scandinavian folklore.
Right. Okay.
That I know.
Okay. So what about well, the thunder god? Is there a word in Slavic languages from modern times for some non-Christian deity making thunder and lightning? Does the name Perun survive?
Since Perun is really, really very known, very well-known figure, it somehow survives, and occasionally it survives as a ordinary lexeme. For example, in Polish language, there is this noun Pioruń, which is the Polish transformation of the name Perun. A Pioruń means lightning, so
yeah,
it makes sense. And in certain dialects of Moravian dialects, there is this curse Doparoma, which is maybe something similar like Perkele, but it means an ordinary curse word.
Okay. So there's no belief that there's a non-Christian being behind thunder and lightning.
In folklore, it's usually Elijah.
Okay.
But not really any like mythological figure with any non-Christian essence or something like that.
Right. Okay, so Elijah, so which can then be understood as a replacement, a stand-in for the pre-Christian figure whom you couldn't mention anymore after the conversion. So you took in the Christian figure that, well, the biblical figure that had a similar role and yeah, could work. Okay. So what about rituals from, in agriculture, hunting, fishing, those things? Are there surviving rituals?
Certain aspects of Slavic paganism may have survived in the cycle of annual festivals. I think those festivals were closely tied to the natural vegetation cycle, and they were mapped later onto the Christian liturgical cycle. But they were basically series of public rituals and communal feasting that were of most importance in Slavic paganism and also in late medieval popular culture. And we know that because the Christian authors criticized this, that the common people were feasting and commuting on those festivals. like the festival of end of the winter and so on, and certain rituals during those festivals or feasts survived, mostly ritual of banishing the winter or banishing the death out of the premises of the village, or taking the death out of the village was the ritual that was recorded even in the 20th century.
So taking death out of the village, and you said the other. I didn't get it.
Death or winter.
Death or winter. Okay. Yep.
This effigy, this figure representation of death and winter was taken out of the village ritually and either burnt or tossed into the swamp or river.
Okay, a figure, a doll, full-size human doll, that represented death or winter, were burned or thrown out in some symbolic way. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. And then in spring, no s rituals connected to sowing or plowing or anything like that.
Yeah, there are a lot of evidence for those folklore rituals of, for example, making the first plowing in the field and sanctifying the field and so on. But yeah, also first sowing and ripening of corn maybe or of fields was important, and it was guaranteed by certain mythological figures. We know that the spirits of ancestors were important for the vegetational cycle and agricultural cycle, so they were invited periodically into the village and into the homes of people to help with the agricultural cycle. And during, for example, during the ripening of fruits and ripening of grain and corn, there were those weird mythological figures of undead young girls who died before their wedding, who were invited to help with this liminal phase of vegetational cycle.
Okay.
So it was also not only related to rituals, but also to these mythological or folkloric figures, entities of numinous essence that were somehow performed during the rituals or offered some offerings or some rituals and so on.
Okay. Good. What about hunting or fishing? Anything like making a small sacrifice to this big oak tree after a successful hunt or something? You leave
Yeah,
a
so
slice of
certainly
the
that.
heart or something to, or the some of the best fat or I don't know, things like that.
Yeah, plenty of evidence for those small scale rituals, so to say, as you mentioned. But I think it's important to say that these rituals and these mythological figures like fairies or forest spirits and domestic spirits, they were embraced by people who identified themselves as Christians, and they turned to these practices and beliefs out of practical necessity, not necessarily out of some deep reverence for tradition they wanted to keep. So yeah, they prayed in the church on Sundays, and later they come home and they left honey under the table or something to feed the ancestors, and then they cleansed their field with holy water, and then they offered cakes and cheese to spirits protecting the house and so on. And they did mix both of those worlds, and it's a complex interplay, but it doesn't necessarily mean that or it certainly doesn't mean that they considered themselves pagan, but we may say that these practices have pagan origins for sure, even though it's not straightforward survivals of paganism or something like that.
Well, that's certainly people weren't considering themselves pagans, but I guess they didn't see a contradiction.
Exactly.
Simply, okay, of course, yeah, we go to church and we are good Christians, but we also do these things, but that's in no opposition to Christianity. It's just our culture. This is the way we do things. So
This
yeah,
is the
which is
way
exactly
things
syncretism,
work.
this mixture of old and new. So it appears quite a bit and has survived, but then of course it's difficult to decide in many cases at least what or difficult to argue or point out explicit arguments that this particular ritual must come from pre-Christian times as a survival, and because it's hard to know, but maybe more when you consider the whole complex, this whole complex of ritual sacrifices in everyday life, you can say it certainly does not come from Christianity. It's so it's much more likely that it's inherited from before the conversion.
Yes, but it's also important to say that these elements of paganism were somehow reinvented or rebadged within the medieval or folklore Christianity of later period. So this syncretic process, this blending of the two religions or more religions, maybe sometimes was this gradual accommodation of Christianity to the customs of common people and vice versa. So,
Yeah, we have much of the same in the Nordic countries. That kind of rituals that clearly has sur have survived from pre-Christian times. So then, if we is it possible to make a comparison between Slavic religion, Slavic paganism, and an Old Norse religion?
Yeah, besides what we already said about the temples,
Temples, yeah.
for example, Slavic and Old Norse religion may have similar threads in the overall nature and structure of their symbolic systems. I mean, these religions were comparable within the Indo-European context. So, for example, the overall approach towards deities, the food offerings for deities, the approach to domestic spirits, this stuff was probably very similar. But what is some specific examples of some comparisons between these Slavic material and Old Norse material, we can move to the realm of these epic narratives of the Slavs, as we mentioned earlier, because some of these epic tales have their counterparts in the sagas or in the theater stories of Old Norse literature.
Say that,
For example, yes. For example, a story about a hero who goes on a quest to the giant land, the lands of giants, or other world, where a series of a seemingly innocent tests challenges his abilities. But there is a twist. These seemingly harmless tasks turn out to be of cosmic importance. For example, one task might involve lifting a bag that, as it turns out, symbolizes the weight of the whole earth. So this is connected with a hero called Sviatogor, who
Called, sorry.
attempts to live. Sviatogor means holy
Sviatogor.
mountain. Sviatogor, it means holy mountain
Okay.
in Russian. And he attempts to lift this bag, and then he succeeds only a little bit. And it's similar to the stories of Thor and Utgarda Loki, and what is happening in the other world where he's being tested by the giants. And this narrative also includes the attacks on the giant that are interpreted only as a mosquito bites and so on. So it's also similar to Utgarda Loki.
Utgarda Loki, Utgarsh Loki. Yeah, okay. So yeah, and of course both Slavic and Old Norse religion are polytheistic religions. There are many gods, but then you have this interesting Western Slavic version with one god more equal than other, than others. So more important than the others. So how about Baltic religion, the pre-Christian religions of the Lithuanians and the Latvians?
Baltic language and Baltic religion was certainly very close to Slavic, and folklore is very similar. But in the for example, regarding differences between those two religions, we may say that Baltic religion was focused on the fire worship and cult of snakes. So these are two elements that we cannot find in the Slavic religion.
Right.
But as we said, the Slavic thunder god Perun has his cousin in this figure of Perkunas or Perkons in the Baltic paganism. So the links are there. And Veles has his counterpart in Velnias figure, who is this trickster devil in the Baltic folklore.
Okay.
So the links are there, certainly.
Yeah. Okay, is it possible to say anything about the essence of Slavic religion, about the attitude to life or world view, values?
Well, in the pagan Slavic worldview, there certainly was a sense of what we may say for sure. There was a sense of human dependency on the decisions of the gods. This is evidenced by the significant role of divination techniques in the official cult. Divination served as a means to seek guidance on important matters, such as embarking on a journey as an individual or engaging in warfare against neighboring tribes and so on. Moreover, the concept of faith also had a profound importance, and had a lot of representation in Slavic beliefs. We can mention beings known as Rožanici, singular Rožanica, derived from the verb meaning to give birth, rodit. These beings were intricately linked with childbirth and held dominion over individuals' faith.
Okay.
So that would be my take to encapsulate briefly the essence. But
Yeah, so fate. You can't resist it. It and wh how you behave doesn't matter because it's already decided.
Yeah,
Ideas
that's a
like
very
that.
common motif in folklore. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You have much of that in Old Norse literature as well. What about political abuse? Neo-Nazis? Are people like that
Yes,
exploiting? Yeah.
unfortunately, it can happen as well with Slavic paganism. What is interesting, it doesn't happen in my country. It doesn't happen in Czech Republic. The Slavic paganism isn't abused by far right movement which is curious, but it is true. They mostly use Nordic or Old Norse religion instead,
Okay,
but certainly.
we succeeded with our imperialism.
Yes, you're
Okay.
very successful.
So we're conquering Europe. Okay.
Something to be
Central
proud
Europe, yeah. Okay. So
But this is not the situation in Russia. In contemporary Russia, or at least there were a lot of contemporary pagan groups that use the ancestral religion and native faith as a political means of achieving their goals.
okay.
So.
So yeah. So they're trying to build a chauvinistic identity using these symbols and traditions.
Yes, that's exactly.
Yeah. Which yeah. Well, that's an interesting difference between the East Slavic and West Slavic areas.
Well, I mean, I cannot claim that there are no neo-Nazis in Czech Republic that wouldn't use Slavic religion as their identity, but it's not as visible as it is in Russia or Belarus or Ukraine or among Southern Slavs, South Slavs. There are also some groups that are rather right politically.
Yeah.
So, and they use Slavic paganism as their religious and political identity.
Okay. So what about the I guess there's a neo-pagan movement. Well, could you say a bit about them? I mean, in general, what kind of people, what ideals do they have mostly?
Well, I must admit that this falls outside of my area of expertise, so I'm not feeling entitled to answer it because I'm not really researching
Okay.
these groups and
Okay.
doing
Fine.
field research. I'm really mostly working with dead people and
Dead people.
dead words
Dead religions, yeah.
I'm afraid of people who are alive and doing stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
That's why I'm a historian, not anthropologist.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's easier and more difficult at the same time.
Yes.
Okay, should we wrap it up there? Or is there anything you would like to add?
No, I think we went through everything. We missed some parts, but that's something that's not important.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for the conversation, Yuri.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Du har nå hørt en podcast fra Høgskolen på Vestlandet. For å høre flere podcaster, besøk hvl.no/podcast.